Chapter 104. Was proportionate when no opportunity came, and this evening at Klezmer's she included Deronda in her anger, because he looked as calm as possible at a distance from her, while she was in danger of betraying her impatience to everyone who spoke to her. She found her only safety in the chill haughtiness which made Mr. Vandernoot remark that Mrs. Grandcourt was becoming a perfect match for her husband. When at last the chances of the evening brought Deronda near her, Sir Hugo and Mrs. Raymond were close by, and could hear every word she said. No matter. Her husband was not near, and her irritation passed without check into a fit of daring which restored the security of her self-possession. Deronda was there at last, and she would compel him to do what she pleased. Already and without effort, rather queenly in her air as she stood, in her white lace and green leaves, she threw a royal permissiveness into her way of saying, "I wish you would come and see me tomorrow between 5 and 6, Mr. Deronda." There could be but one answer at that moment, certainly, with a tone of obedience. Afterward it occurred to Deronda that he would write a note to excuse himself. He had always avoided making a call at Grandcourt's. He could not persuade himself to any step that might hurt her, and whether his excuse were taken for indifference or for the affectation of indifference, it would be equally wounding. He kept his promise. Gwendolyn had declined to ride out on the plea of not feeling well enough, having left her refusal to the last moment, when the horses were soon to be at the door, not without alarm lest her husband should say that he too would stay at home. Become almost superstitious about his power of suspicious divination, as he had a glancing forethought of what she would do in that case, namely, have herself denied as not well. But Grandcourt accepted her excuse without remark, and rode off. Nevertheless, when Gwendolyn found herself alone, and had sent down the order that only Mr. Deronda was to be admitted, she began to be alarmed at what he had done, and to feel a growing agitation in the thought that he would soon appear, and she should soon be obliged to speak. Not of trivialities, as if he had no serious motive in asking him to come. And yet what he had been for hours determining to say began to seem impossible. For the first time the impulse of appeal to him was being checked by timidity, and now that it was too late she was shaken by the possibility that he might think her invitation unbecoming. If so, she would have sunk in his esteem. But immediately she resisted this intolerable fear as an infection from her husband's way of thinking. That he would say she was making a fool of herself was rather a reason why such a judgment would be remote from Deronda's mind. But that she could not rid herself from this sudden invasion of womanly reticence was manifest in a kind of action which had never occurred to her before. In her struggle between agitation and the effort to suppress it, she was walking up and down the length of the two drawing rooms, where at one end a long mirror reflected her in her black dress, chosen in the early morning with a half-admitted reference to this hour. But above this black dress her head on its white pillar of a neck showed to advantage. Some consciousness of this made her turn hastily and hurry to the boudoir, where again there was a glass, but also, tossed over a chair, a large piece of black lace which she snatched and tied over her crown of hair so as completely to conceal her neck and leave only her face looking out from the black frame. In this manifest contempt of appearance, she thought it possible to be freer from nervousness, but the black lace did not take away the uneasiness from her eyes and lips. She was standing in the middle of the room when Deronda was announced, and as he approached her, she perceived that he too for some reason was not his usual self. She could not have defined the change except by saying that he looked less happy than usual, and appeared to be under some effort in speaking to her. And yet the speaking was the slightest possible. They both said, "How do you do?" quite curtly. And Gwendolyn, instead of sitting down, moved to a little distance, resting her arms slightly on the tall back of a chair, while Deronda stood where he was, both feeling it difficult to say any more, though the preoccupation in his mind could hardly have been more remote than it was from Gwendolyn's conception. She naturally saw in his embarrassment some reflection of her own. Forced to speak, she found all her training in concealment and self-command of no use to her, and began with timid awkwardness, "You will wonder why. I begged you to come. I wanted to ask you something. You said I was ignorant. That is true. And what can I do but ask you?" And at this moment she was feeling it utterly impossible to put the questions as he had intended. Something new in her nervous manner roused Deronda's anxiety lest there might be a new crisis. He said with the sadness of affection in his voice, "My only regret is that I can be of so little use to you." The words and the tone touched a new spring in her, and she went on with more sense of freedom, yet still not saying anything as he had designed to say, and beginning to hurry, that she might somehow arrive at the right words. "I wanted to tell you that I have always been thinking of your advice, but is it any use? I can't make myself different, because things about me raise bad feelings and I must go on. I can alter nothing. It is no use." She paused an instant, with the consciousness that she was not finding the right words, but began again hurriedly, "But if I go on I shall get worse. I want not to get worse. I should like to be what you wish. There are people who are good, and enjoy great things. I know there are. I am a contemptible creature. I feel as if I should get wicked with hating people. I have tried to think that I would go away from everybody. But I can't. There are so many things to hinder me. You think, perhaps, that I don't mind. But I do mind. I am afraid of everything. I am afraid of getting wicked. Tell me what I can do." As he had forgotten everything but that image of her helpless misery which he was trying to make present to Deronda in broken elusive speech, wishing to convey, but not express, all her need. Her eyes were tearless, and had a look of smarting in their dilated brilliance eye. There was a subdued sob in her voice which was more and more veiled, till it was hardly above a whisper. She was hurting herself with the jewels that glittered on her tightly clasped fingers pressed against her heart. The feeling Deronda endured in these moments he afterward called horrible. Words seemed to have no more rescue in them than if he had been beholding a vessel in peril of wreck, the poor ship with its many lived anguish beaten by the inescapable storm. How could he grasp the long-growing process of this young creature's wretchedness, arrest and change it with a sentence? He was afraid of his own voice. The words that rushed into his mind seemed in their feebleness nothing better than despair made audible, or than that insensibility to another's hardship which applies precept to soothe pain. He felt himself holding a crowd of words imprisoned within his lips, as if the letting them escape would be a violation of awe before the mysteries of our human lot. The thought that urged itself foremost was, "Confess everything to your husband. Have nothing concealed." The words carried in his mind a vision of reasons which would have needed much fuller expressions for Gwendolyn to apprehend them, but before he had begun those brief sentences, the door opened and the husband entered. Grandcourt had deliberately gone out and turned back to satisfy a suspicion. What he saw was Gwendolyn's face of anguish framed black like a nun's, and Deronda standing 3 yards from her with a look of sorrow such as he might have bent on the last struggle of life in a beloved object. Without any show of surprise, Grandcourt nodded to Deronda, gave a second look at Gwendolyn, passed on, and seated himself easily at a little distance, crossing his legs, taking out his handkerchief and trifling with it elegantly. Gwendolyn had shrunk and changed her attitude on seeing him, but she did not turn or move from her place. It was not a moment in which she could feign anything or manifest any strong revulsion of feeling. The passionate movement of her last speech was still too strong within her. What she felt beside was a dull, despairing sense that her interview with Deronda was at an end. A curtain had fallen. But he, naturally, was urged into self-possession and effort by susceptibility to what might follow for her from being seen by her husband in this betrayal of agitation, and feeling that any pretense of ease in prolonging his visit would only exaggerate Grandcourt's possible conjectures of duplicity, he merely said, "I will not stay longer now. Goodbye." He put out his hand, and she let him press her poor little chill fingers. But she said no goodbye. When he had left the room, Gwendolyn threw herself into a seat, with an expectation as dull as her despair, the expectation that she was going to be punished. But Grandcourt took no notice. He was satisfied to have let her know that S. he had not deceived him, and to keep a silence which was formidable with omniscience. He went out that evening, and her plea of feeling ill was accepted without even a sneer. The next morning at breakfast he said, "I am going yachting to the Mediterranean." "When?" said Gwendolyn, with a leap of heart which had hope in it. "The day after tomorrow. The yacht is at Marseille. Lush is gone to get everything ready." "Shall I have Mama to stay with me then?" said Gwendolyn, the new sudden possibility of peace and affection filling her mind like a burst of morning light. "No, you will go with me." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.